Chapter 4. The End of Peace in Europe. The Great Exhibition opened in Hyde Park on the 1st of May 1851. 6 million people, a third of the entire population of Britain at that time, would pass through the mammoth exhibition halls in the specially constructed Crystal Palace, the largest glass house yet built, and marvel at the 13,000 exhibits, manufactures, handicrafts, and various other objects from around the world. Coming as it did after 2 decades of social and political upheaval, the Great Exhibition seemed to hold the promise of a more prosperous and peaceful age based upon the British principles of industrialism and free trade. The architectural wonder of the Crystal Palace was itself proof of British manufacturing ingenuity, a fitting place to house an exhibition whose aim was to show that Britain held the lead in almost every field of industry. It symbolised the Pax Britannica, which the British expected to dispense to Europe and the world. The only possible threat to peace appeared to come from France. Through a coup d'état on the 2nd of December 1851, the anniversary of Napoleon's coronation as emperor in 1804, Louis Napoleon, the president of the Second Republic, overthrew the constitution and established himself as dictator. By a national referendum the following November, the Second Republic became the Second Empire, and on the 2nd of December 1852, Louis Napoleon became the Emperor of the French, Napoleon III. The appearance of a new French emperor put the great powers on alert. In Britain, there were fears of a Napoleonic revival. MPs demanded the recall of the Lisbon squadron to guard the English Channel against the French. Lord Raglan, the future leader of the British forces in the Crimean War, spent the summer of 1852 planning the defences of London against a potential attack by the French Navy, and that remained the top priority of British naval planning throughout 1853. Count Boil, the Austrian foreign minister, demanded confirmation of Napoleon's peaceful intentions. The Tsar wanted him to make a humiliating disclaimer of any aggressive plans, and promised Austria 60,000 troops if it was attacked by France. In an attempt to reassure them all, Napoleon made a declaration in Bordeaux in October 1852. "Mistrustful people say the Empire means war, but I say the Empire means peace." In truth, there were reasons to be mistrustful. It was hardly likely that Napoleon III would remain content with the existing settlement of Europe, which had been set up to contain France after the Napoleonic Wars. His genuine and extensive popularity among the French rested on his stirring of their Bonapartist memories, even though in almost every way he was inferior to his uncle. Indeed, with his large and awkward body, short legs, moustache and goatee beard, he looked more like a banker than a Bonaparte. Extremely short, but with a head and bust which ought to belong to a much taller man, is how Queen Victoria described him in her diary after she had met him for the first time in 1855. Napoleon's foreign policy was largely driven by his need to play to this Bonapartist tradition. He aimed to restore France to a position of respect and influence abroad, if not to the glory of his uncle's reign, by revising the 1815 settlement and reshaping Europe as a family of liberal nation-states along the lines supposedly envisaged by Napoleon I. This was an aim he thought he could achieve by forging an alliance with Britain, the traditional enemy of France. His close political ally and Minister of the Interior, the Duc de Persigny, who had spent some time in London in 1852, persuaded him that Britain was no longer dominated by the aristocracy, but a new bourgeois power that was set to dominate the continent. By allying with Britain, France would be able to develop a great and glorious foreign policy, and avenge our past defeats more effectively than through any gain that we might make by refighting the Battle of Waterloo. Russia was the one country the French could fight to restore their national pride. the memory of Napoleon's retreat from Moscow, which had done so much to hasten the collapse of the First Empire, the subsequent military defeats and the Russian occupation of Paris were constant sources of pain and humiliation to the French. Russia was the major force behind the 1815 settlement and the restoration of the Bourbon dynasty in France. The Tsar was the enemy of liberty and a major obstacle to the development of free nation states on the European continent. He was also the only sovereign not to recognize the new Napoleon as emperor. Britain, Austria, and Prussia were all prepared to grant him that status, albeit reluctantly in the case of the last two. But Nicholas refused, on the grounds that emperors were made by God, not elected by referendums. The Tsar showed his contempt for Napoleon by addressing him as mon ami rather than mon frère, the customary greeting to another member of the European family of ruling sovereigns. Some of Napoleon's advisers, Persigny in particular, wanted him to seize on the insult and force a break with Russia. But the French emperor would not begin his reign with a personal quarrel, and he passed it off with the remark, "God gives us brothers, but we choose our friends." For Napoleon, the conflict with Russia in the Holy Lands served as a means of reuniting France after the divisions of 1848-9. The revolutionary left could be reconciled to the coup d'état and the Second Empire if it was engaged in a patriotic fight for liberty against the gendarmes of Europe. As for the Catholic right, it had long been pushing for a crusade against the orthodox heresy that was threatening Christendom and French civilization. It was in this context that Napoleon appointed the extreme Catholic Lavalette as French ambassador to Constantinople. Lavalette was part of a powerful clerical lobby at the Quai d'Orsay, the French foreign ministry, which used its influence to raise the stakes in the Holy Land's dispute, according to Persigny. "Our foreign policy was often troubled by a clerical lobby, coterie clericale, which wormed its way into the secret recesses of the foreign ministry. The 2nd of December had not succeeded in dislodging it. On the contrary, it became even more audacious, profiting from our preoccupation with domestic matters to entangle our diplomacy in the complications of the holy places, where it hailed its infantile successes as national triumphs." Lavalette's aggressive proclamation that the Latin right to the holy places had been clearly established, backed up by his threat of using the French navy to support these claims against Russia, was greeted with approval by the ultra-Catholic press in France. Napoleon himself was more moderate and conciliatory in his approach to the Holy Land's dispute. He confessed to the chief of the political directorate, Édouard Antoine de Touvenel, that he was ignorant about the details of the contested claims and regretted that the religious conflict had been blown out of all proportion, as indeed it had. But his need to curry favour with Catholic opinion at home, combined with his plans for an alliance with Britain against Russia, also meant that it was not in his interests to restrain Lavalette's provocative behaviour. It was not until the spring of 1852 that he finally recalled the ambassador from the Turkish capital, and then only following complaints about Lavalette by Lord Malmesbury, the British Foreign Secretary. But even after his recall, the French continued with their gunboat policy to pressure the Sultan into concessions, confident that it would enrage the Tsar, and hopeful that it would force the British to ally with France against Russian aggression. The policy paid dividends. In November 1852, the Porte issued a new ruling granting to the Catholics the right to hold a key to the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, allowing them free access to the Chapel of the Manger and the Grotto of the Nativity. With Stratford Canning away in England, the British chargé d'affaires in Constantinople, Colonel Hugh Rose, explained the ruling by the fact that the latest gunship in the French steam fleet, the Charlemagne, could sail at 8.5 knots from the Mediterranean, while its sister ship, the Napoleon, could sail at 12, meaning that the French could defeat the technologically backward Russian and Turkish fleets combined. the Tsar was furious with the Turks for caving in to French pressure and threatened violence of his own. On the 27th of December, he ordered the mobilization of 37,000 troops from the 4th and 5th Army Corps in Bessarabia in preparation for a lightning strike on the Turkish capital, and a further 91,000 soldiers for a simultaneous campaign in the Danubian principalities and the rest of the Balkans. It was a sign of his petulance that he made the order on his own, without consulting either Nesselrode, the foreign minister, Prince Dolgorukov, the Minister of War, or even Count Orlov, the chief of the Third Section, with whom he conferred nearly every day. At the court, there was talk of dismembering the Ottoman Empire, starting with the Russian occupation of the Danubian principalities. In a memorandum written in the final weeks of 1852, Nicholas set out his plans for the partition of the Ottoman Empire. Russia was to gain the Danubian principalities and Dobrogea, the river's delta lands. Serbia and Bulgaria would become independent states. The Adriatic coast would go to Austria. Cyprus, Rhodes, and Egypt to Britain. France would gain Crete. An enlarged Greece would be created from the archipelago. Constantinople would become a free city under international protection, and the Turks were to be ejected from Europe. At this point, Nicholas began a new round of negotiations with the British, whose overwhelming naval power would make them the decisive factor in any showdown between France and Russia in the Near East. Still convinced that he had forged an understanding with the British during his 1844 visit, he now believed that he could call on them to restrain the French and enforce Russia's treaty rights in the Ottoman Empire. But he also hoped to convince them that the time had come for the partition of Turkey. The Tsar held a series of conversations with Lord Seymour, the British ambassador in St. Petersburg, during January and February of 1853. "We have a sick man on our hands," he began on the subject of Turkey, "a man gravely ill. It will be a great misfortune if he slips through our hands, especially before the necessary arrangements are made." With the Ottoman Empire falling to pieces, it was very important for Britain and Russia to reach an agreement on its organized partition, if only to prevent the French from sending an expedition to the east, an eventuality that would force him to order his troops into Ottoman territory. "When England and Russia are agreed," the Tsar told Seymour, "it is immaterial what the other powers think or do." Speaking as a gentleman, Nicholas assured the ambassador that Russia had renounced the territorial ambitions of Catherine the Great. He had no desire to conquer Constantinople, which he wanted to become an international city, but for that reason he could not allow the British or the French to seize control of it. In the chaos of an Ottoman collapse, he would be forced to take the capital on a temporary basis, en dépositaire, to prevent the breaking up of Turkey into little republics, asylums for the Kossuths and Mazzinis and other revolutionists of Europe, and to protect the Eastern Christians from the Turks. "I cannot recede from the discharge of a sacred duty," the Tsar emphasized. "Our religion, as established in this country, came to us from the East, and these are feelings as well as obligations which never must be lost sight of." Seymour was not shocked by the Tsar's partition plans, and in his first report to Lord John Russell, the Foreign Secretary, he even seemed to welcome the idea. If Russia and Britain, the two Christian powers most interested in the destinies of Turkey, could take the place of Muslim rule in Europe, a noble triumph would be obtained by the civilization of the 19th century, he argued. There were many in the coalition government of Lord Aberdeen, including Russell and William Gladstone, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who wondered whether it was right to go on propping up the Ottoman Empire while Christians were being persecuted by the Turks. But others were committed to the Tanzimat reforms and wanted time for them to work. Procrastination certainly suited the British, since they were caught between the Russians and the French, whom they distrusted equally. "The Russians accuse us of being too French," the astute Queen Victoria remarked, "and the French accuse us of being too Russian." the cabinet rejected the Tsar's notion that an Ottoman collapse was imminent and agreed not to plan ahead for hypothetical contingencies, a course of action likely in itself to hasten the demise of the Ottoman Empire by provoking Christian uprisings and inspiring repression by the Turks. Indeed, the Tsar's insistence on an imminent collapse raised suspicions in Westminster that he was plotting and precipitating it by his actions. As Seymour noted of his conversation with the Tsar on the 21st of February, it can hardly be otherwise but that the sovereign who insists with such pertinacity upon the impending fate of a neighbouring state must have settled in his own mind that the hour of its dissolution is at hand. In his later conversations with Seymour, Nicholas became more confident and even more revealing about his partition plans. He talked of reducing Turkey to a vassal state as he had done with Poland, and of giving independence to the Danubian principalities, Serbia and Bulgaria, under Russian protection, and he claimed that he had the support of Austria. "You must understand," he told Seymour, "that when I speak of Russia, I speak of Austria as well. What suits the one suits the other. Our interests as regards Turkey are perfectly identical." Seymour, for his part, was increasingly put off by the Tsar's rash and reckless plans. He seemed prepared to gamble everything on a war against Turkey and put them down to the arrogance of autocratic power accumulated over nearly 30 years. The Tsar's confidence was surely also based on his misapprehension that he enjoyed the support of the British government. He felt that he had formed a bond with Lord Aberdeen in 1844, when Aberdeen, now Prime Minister and the most pro-Russian of all the British leaders, was Foreign Secretary. Nicholas assumed that Aberdeen's backing for Russia's position in the Holy Land's dispute implied British agreement with his partition plans. In a dispatch from London in early February, the Russian ambassador, Baron Brunov, informed the Tsar that Aberdeen had remarked off the cuff that the Ottoman government was the worst in the world and that the British had little inclination to support it any longer. The report encouraged Nicholas to speak more freely to Seymour and, in the belief that an Anglo-French alliance was no longer to be feared, to take a more aggressive line against the French and the Turks in the spring of 1853. He had no idea of the growing isolation of Aberdeen within his own cabinet on the Eastern question, no appreciation of the general drift in British policy against Russia. To force the Sultan to restore Russia's rights in the holy places, the Tsar dispatched his own envoy to Constantinople in February 1853. The choice of envoy was deliberate and itself a sign of his militant intentions for the mission. Instead of choosing a seasoned diplomat who might have furthered peace, Nicholas decided on a military man with a fearful reputation. Prince Alexander Menshikov was 65 years old, a veteran of the wars against the French in 1812 and an admiral in the war against the Turks in 1828-9, when he was castrated by a cannonball. He had experience as a naval minister involved in plans to seize the Turkish Straits, as governor-general of occupied Finland in 1831, and as a negotiator with Persia. Menshikov was a remarkably well-informed man in Seymour's estimation, with more independence of character than perhaps belongs to any of the emperor's associates. His peculiar turn of thought constantly showing itself by sarcastic observations which make him a little dreaded in St. Petersburg. But he lacked the necessary tact and patience to act as an appeaser with the Turks, which, as Seymour wrote, was noteworthy. If it were necessary to send a military man to Constantinople, the emperor could hardly have made a better selection than he has done. It is, however, impossible not to reflect that the choice of a soldier has in itself a certain significance, and that, should a negotiation prove ineffectual, the negotiator may readily become the commander, who has authority to call in 100,000 soldiers and to place himself at their head. Menshikov's mission was to demand from the Sultan the nullification of the November ruling in favour of the Catholics, the restoration of Greek privileges in the Holy Sepulchre, and reparation in the form of a formal convention or sened that would guarantee the treaty rights of Russia, supposedly dating back to the 1774 Treaty of Kuchuk-Kainaji, to represent the Orthodox not just in the Holy Lands but throughout the Ottoman Empire. If the French resisted Greek control of the Holy Sepulchre, Menshikov was to propose a secret defensive alliance in which Russia would put a fleet and 400,000 Russian troops at the Sultan's disposal, should he ever need them against a Western power, on condition that he exercised his sovereignty in favour of the Orthodox. According to his diary, Menshikov was given the command of the army and the fleet, and the post of envoy plenipotentiary of peace or war. His instructions were to combine persuasion with military threats. The Tsar had already approved plans to occupy the Danubian principalities and grant them independence if the Turks rejected Menshikov's demands. He had ordered the advance of 140,000 soldiers to the frontiers of the principalities and was prepared to use these troops with the Black Sea fleet to seize Constantinople if that should be needed to force the Sultan into submission. There was a flamboyant review of the fleet at Sevastopol to coincide with Menshikov's departure for the Turkish capital, where he arrived on the aptly named steam frigate Thunderer on the 28th of February. Cheered by a huge crowd of Greeks who had gathered at the port to welcome him, Menshikov was accompanied by a large suite of military and naval officers, including General Nepokoichitsky, Chief of Staff of the 4th Army Corps, and Vice Admiral Vladimir Kornilov, Chief of Staff of the Black Sea Fleet, whose mission was to spy on the defences of the Bosporus and Constantinople in preparation for a lightning attack. Menshikov's demands stood little chance of being met in their original form. The fact that the Tsar had even thought they might succeed suggests how far removed he was from political reality. The draft of the Sened prepared by Nesselrode went well beyond the dispute in the Holy Lands. In effect, Russia was demanding a new treaty that would reassert its rights of protection of the Greek Church throughout the Ottoman Empire, and, insofar as the Orthodox patriarchs were to be appointed for life, without any control by the Porte. European Turkey would become a Russian protectorate, and the Ottoman Empire would, in practical terms, become a dependency of Russia, always threatened by her military might. But whatever chances of diplomatic success the admiral might have had, they were ruined by the way Menshikov behaved in the Turkish capital. 2 days after he arrived, he broke with diplomatic precedent and insulted the Turks by appearing in civilian clothes and an overcoat instead of full uniform for his ceremonial welcome by the port. Meeting the Grand Vizier Mehmet Ali, Menshikov immediately demanded the dismissal of Fuad Effendi, the foreign minister, who had caved in to the French in November, and refused to begin negotiations until a new foreign minister, more amenable to Russia's interests, had been appointed. In a calculated affront to Fuad, Menshikov refused to speak with him, in full view of a large crowd. It was an act to demonstrate that a minister hostile to Russia would be humiliated and punished even in the midst of the Sultan's court. The Turks were appalled by Menshikov's behaviour, but the build-up of Russian troops in Bessarabia was worrying enough to make them acquiesce to his demands. Swallowing their pride, they even allowed the Russian dragoman to interview Fuad's successor, Rifat Pasha, on behalf of Menshikov before appointing him as foreign minister. But Menshikov's continued bullying, his threats to break off relations with the port unless it satisfied his demands at once, also alienated the Turkish ministers and made them more inclined to resist his pressure by turning to the British and the French for help. It was a question of defending Turkey's sovereignty. By the end of the first week of Menshikov's mission, the gist of his instructions had been leaked or sold by Turkish officials to all the Western embassies, and a nervous Mehmet Ali had consulted with the French and British charge d'affaires, secretly requesting them to call up their fleets to the Aegean in case they were needed to defend the Turkish capital against an attack by the Russians. Colonel Rose was particularly alarmed at Menshikov's actions. He feared that the Russians were about to impose on the Turks a new treaty of Unkiari-Skelesi, or something worse, by the occupation of the Dardanelles, a clear abrogation of the 1841 Straits Convention. He believed he had to act, without waiting until the return of Stratford Canning, who had resigned the ambassadorship in January, but had been reappointed by the Aberdeen government in February. On the 8th of March, Rose sent a message by fast steamer to Vice-Admiral Sir James Dundas in Malta, calling on him to bring up his squadron to Ula near Izmir. Dundas refused to obey the order without confirmation from the government in London, where a group of ministers who were later to become the inner cabinet of the Crimean War met to discuss Rose's appeal on the 20th of March. The ministers were concerned by the Russian military build-up in Bessarabia, by the vast naval preparations at Sevastopol, and the hostile language used by Menshikov towards the port. Convinced that the Russians were preparing to destroy Turkey, Russell was inclined to let their fleets advance into the Bosporus and seize the Turkish capital, so that Britain and France could use the defence of the Straits Convention as a reason to launch a full-out naval war against Russia in the Black Sea and the Baltic. Supported by Palmerston, Russell would have had the majority of the British public on his side. But the other ministers were more cautious. They were wary of the French, whom they still regarded as a military threat, and disagreed with Russell that an Anglo-French alliance would counteract the challenge of the French steam fleet to British maritime power. They took the view that the French had provoked the Russians, who deserved a concession in the Holy Lands, and trusted the assurances of Baron Brunnoff, as a gentleman, that the Tsar's intentions remained peaceful. On this basis, they rejected Rose's request for a squadron. It was not up to chargés d'affaires, it seemed to them, to call up fleets or decide matters of war and peace, and Rose had allowed himself to be swayed by the alarm of the Turkish government and the rumours that obtained general credit at Constantinople of the advancing army and fleet of Russia. The ministers decided that they would wait for Stratford Canning to return to the Turkish capital and sought out a peaceful settlement. News of Rose's summons to Dundas arrived in Paris on the 16th of March. In a cabinet meeting to discuss the situation 3 days later, Drouin de Lhuys, the foreign minister, painted a picture of imminent catastrophe. "The last hour of Turkey has been tolled, and we must expect to see the double-headed eagle of the Romanovs planted on the towers of St. Sophia." Drouin rejected the idea of sending in a fleet, at least not until the British did, in case they should be isolated in Europe, which feared the reassertion of Napoleonic France. This was also the position of the other ministers, except Persigny, who claimed that Britain would rejoice and join our side if France took a stand to stop the march of Russia towards Constantinople. For Persigny, it was a question of national honour. The army that had carried out the coup d'état on the 2nd of December was an army of Praetorians with a heritage of glory to defend. He warned Napoleon that if he temporized as his ministers advised, "The first time you pass before your troops, you will see their faces saddened, the ranks silenced, and you will feel the ground shake beneath your feet. So, as you well know, to win back the army you must take some risks. And you, messieurs, who would have peace at any price, you will be thrown into a terrible conflagration." At this point, the emperor, who had been wavering over what to do, succumbed to the argument of Persigny and ordered the advance of the French fleet, not as far as the Dardanelles, but to Salamis in Greek waters, as a warning to the Russians that France was not disinterested in what took place in Constantinople. There were three main reasons behind his decision to mobilise the fleet. First, as Persigny had intimated, there were rumours of a plot against Napoleon in the army, and a show of force was a good way to nip this in the bud. "I must tell you," Napoleon wrote to Empress Eugenie in the winter of 1852, "that serious plots are afoot in the army. I am keeping my eye on all this, and I reckon that by one means or another I can prevent any outbreak. perhaps by means of a war. Secondly, Napoleon was anxious to restore France as a naval power in the Mediterranean, for everybody knew, in the words of Horace de Vielcastel, the director of the Louvre, that the day when the Mediterranean is partitioned between Russia and England, France will no longer be counted among the great powers. In a conversation with Stratford Canning, who passed through Paris on his way from London to Constantinople, Napoleon was concerned to highlight France's interests in the Mediterranean. Stratford wrote this memorandum of their conversation on the 10th of March. He said that he had no wish to make the Mediterranean a French lake, to use a well-known expression, but that he should like to see it made a European one. He did not explain the meaning of this phrase. If he meant that the shores of the Mediterranean should be exclusively in the hands of Christendom, the dream is rather colossal. The impression left upon my mind is that Louis Napoleon, meaning to be well with us, at least for the present, is ready to act politically in concert with England at Constantinople, but it remains to be seen whether he looks to the restoration of Turkish power or merely to the consequences of its decay, preparing to avail himself of them hereafter in the interests of France. But above all, it was Napoleon's desire to act in concert with England and establish an Anglo-French alliance that led him to mobilize the fleet. "Persigny is right," he told his ministers on the 19th of March. "If we send our fleet to Salamis, England will be forced to do as much, and the union of the two fleets will lead to the union of the two nations against Russia." According to Persigny, the emperor reasoned that the dispatch of the fleet would appeal to British Russophobia, win support from the bourgeois press, and force the hand of the more cautious Aberdeen government to join France. In fact, the British fleet remained at Malta while the French sailed from Toulon on the 22nd of March. The British were furious with the French for escalating the crisis and urged them not to advance beyond Naples, giving Stratford time to get to Constantinople and arrange a settlement before moving their gunboats into the Aegean Sea. Stratford arrived in the Turkish capital on the 5th of April. He found the Turks already in a mood to stand up to Menshikov. Nationalist and religious emotions had become highly charged, although there were divisions about how far they should go and how long they should wait for the military backing of the West. These arguments became entangled in the long-standing personal rivalry between the Grand Vizier Mehmet Ali and Reshid, Stratford's old ally, who was then out of power. Hearing that Mehmet Ali was about to make a compromise with Menshikov, Stratford urged him to stand firm against the Russians, assuring him, on his own authority, that the British fleet would back him if need be. The key thing, he advised, was to separate the conflict in the Holy Lands, where Russia had a legitimate claim for the restoration of its treaty rights, and the broader demands of the draft Senedd that had to be rejected to maintain Turkish sovereignty. It was vital for the Sultan to grant religious rights by direct sovereign authority rather than by any mechanism dictated by Russia. In Stratford's view, the Tsar's real intention was to use his protection of the Greek Church as a Trojan horse for the penetration and dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire. The Grand Council heeded his advice when it met to discuss Menshikov's demands on the 23rd of April. It agreed to negotiate on the holy places, but not on the broader question concerning Russia's protection of the Sultan's Orthodox subjects. On the 5th of May, Menshikov came back with a revised version of the Senedd, without the life appointment of the patriarchs, but with an ultimatum that if it was not signed within 5 days, he would leave Constantinople and break off diplomatic relations. Stratford urged the Sultan to hold firm, and the Ottoman cabinet rejected the ultimatum on the 10th of May. In a desperate bid to satisfy the Tsar's demands without recourse to war, Menshikov gave the Turks 4 more days to sign the revised Senedd. During this reprieve, Stratford and Reshid engineered the dismissal of Mehmet Ali, allowing Reshid to take over at the Foreign Ministry. Following the advice of the British ambassador, Rashid was in favour of a firmer line against the Russians on the understanding that this was the surest way to reach a settlement on the religious question without compromising the sovereignty of the Sultan. Rashid asked for 5 more days from Menshikov. News had come from the Ottoman ambassador in London, Kostaki Musurus, that Britain would defend the sovereign rights of the Ottoman Empire, and this emboldened the new Turkish foreign minister, who needed time to win support for a firm stand against the Russians among his fellow ministers. On the 15th of May, the Grand Council met again. The ministers and Muslim leaders were fired up with anti-Russian sentiment, much of it encouraged by Stratford, who had called on many of them personally to urge them to stand firm. The council refused Menshikov's demands. Receiving the news that evening, Menshikov replied that Russia would now break off relations with the port, but that he would wait a few more days in the Turkish capital, citing storms in the Black Sea as a reason to delay his departure, though really he was hoping for a last-minute deal. Finally, on the 21st of May, the Russian coat of arms was taken down from the embassy, and Menshikov departed for Odessa on the Thunderer. The failure of the Menshikov mission convinced the Tsar that he needed to resort to military means. On the 29th of May, he wrote to Field Marshal Paskevich that if he had been more aggressive from the start, he might have been successful in extracting concessions from the Turks. He did not want a war, he feared the intervention of the Western powers, but he was now prepared to use the threat of war to shake the Turkish Empire to its foundations, to get his way and enforce what he saw as Russia's treaty rights to protect the Orthodox. He revealed his thinking and state of mind to Paskevich. "The consequence of Menshikov's failure is war. However, before I get to that, I have decided to send my troops into the Danubian principalities to show the world how far I would go to avoid war, and send a final ultimatum to the Turks to satisfy my demands within 8 days, and if they don't, I shall declare war on them. My aim is to occupy the principalities without a war, if the Turks do not meet us on the left bank of the Danube. If the Turks resist, I shall blockade the Bosporus and seize Turkish ships on the Black Sea, and I shall propose to Austria to occupy Herzegovina and Serbia. If that does not take effect, I shall declare the independence of the principalities, Serbia and Herzegovina, and then the Turkish Empire will begin to crumble, for everywhere there will be Christian uprisings, and the last hour of the Ottoman Empire will sound. I do not intend to cross the Danube. The Turkish Empire will collapse without that, but I shall keep my fleet prepared, and the 13th and 14th Divisions will remain on a war footing in Sevastopol and Odessa. Canning's actions do not put me off. I must go by my own path and fulfill my duty according to my faith as befits the honour of Russia. You cannot imagine how much all this saddens me. I have grown old, but I would like to end my life in peace." The Tsar's plan was the result of a compromise between his own initial inclination to seize Constantinople in a surprise attack before the Western powers could react, and the more cautious thinking of Paskevich. Paskevich had commanded the punitive campaign against the Hungarians and the Poles, and was the Tsar's most trusted military adviser. He was sceptical about such an offensive, and fearful that it would entangle Russia in a European-wide war. The key difference between the two centred on their views of Austria. Nicholas put excessive faith in his personal link to Franz Joseph. He was convinced that the Austrians, whom he had saved from the Hungarians in 1849, would join him in his threats against the Turks, and, if necessary, in the partition of the Ottoman Empire. That is what had made him so aggressive in his foreign policy, the belief that with Austria on his side there could be no European war and the Turks would be forced to capitulate. Paskevich, by contrast, was doubtful about Austrian support. As he correctly understood, the Austrians could hardly be expected to welcome Russian troops in the Principalities and the Balkans, where they already feared uprisings against them by the Serbs and other Slavs. They might even join the Western powers against Russia if these revolts materialized, if and when the Tsar's troops crossed the Danube. Determined to limit the Tsar's offensive plans, Paskevich played to his pan-Slav fantasies. He persuaded Nicholas that it would be enough for Russian troops to occupy the principalities in a defensive war for the Balkan Slavs to rise up and force the Turks to give in to the Tsar's demands. He spoke of occupying the principalities for several years, if necessary, and claimed that Russian propaganda would raise as many as 50,000 Christian soldiers for the Tsar's army in the Balkans, enough to deter the intervention of the Western powers and at least neutralize the Austrians. In a memorandum to the Tsar in early April, Paskevich outlined his vision of the religious war that would unfold in the Balkans as the Russian troops advanced. "The Christians of Turkey are from warring tribes, and if the Serbs and Bulgarians have remained peaceful, it is only because they have not yet felt Turkish rule in their villages. But their warrior spirit will be roused by the first conflict between Christians and Muslims. They will not stand for the atrocities that the Turks will carry out against their villages when our armies begin the war. There is not a village, perhaps not a family, where there won't be oppressed Christians, willing to join us in our fight against the Turks. We will have a weapon that can bring the Turkish Empire down." Towards the end of June, the Tsar ordered his two armies in Bessarabia to cross the River Pruth and occupy Moldavia and Wallachia. Paskevich still hoped that the invasion of the principalities would not lead to a European war, but feared that the Tsar would not pull back from it if that should be the case, as he explained to General Gortchakov, the commander of the Russian forces, on the 24th of June. The Tsar's troops advanced to Bucharest, where their command established headquarters. In every town, they posted copies of a manifesto from the Tsar, in which it was stated that Russia did not want to make territorial gains and was only occupying the principalities as a guarantee for the satisfaction of its religious grievances by the Ottoman government. "We are ready to stop our troops if the port guarantees the inviolable rights of the Orthodox Church, but if it continues to resist, then with God on our side, we shall advance and fight for our true faith." The occupying troops had little understanding of the dispute in the Holy Lands. "We did not think of anything. We knew nothing. We let our commanders think for us and did what they told us," recalled Theophile Klemm, a veteran of the Danubian campaign. Klemm was just 18, a literate serf who had been chosen for training as an officer in Kremenchuk in the Ukraine when he was called up by the infantry in 1853. Klemm was unimpressed by the pan-Slav pamphlets that circulated widely among the troops and officers of the Fifth Army Corps. "None of us were interested in such ideas," he wrote. But like every soldier in the Russian army, Klemm went off to battle with a cross around his neck, and with an understanding of his calling as a fight for God. The Russian army was a peasant army. Serfs and state peasants were the main groups subject to the military draft, and that was its main problem. It was by far the biggest army in the world, with over 1 million infantry, 250,000 irregulars, mainly Cossack cavalry, and 750,000 reservists in special military settlements. But even this was not enough to defend the enormous borders of Russia, where there were so many vulnerable points, such as the Baltic coast, or Poland, or the Caucasus, and the army could not recruit more without running down the serf economy and sparking peasant uprisings. The weakness of the population base in European Russia, a territory the size of the rest of Europe but with less than a fifth of its population, was compounded by the concentration of the serf population in the central agricultural zone of Russia, a long way from the empire's borders, where the army would be needed at short notice in the event of war. Without railways, it took months for serfs to be recruited and sent by foot or cart to their regiments. Even before the Crimean War, the Russian army was already overstretched. Virtually all the serfs eligible for conscription had been mobilized, and the quality of the recruits had declined significantly, as landowners and villages, desperate to hold on to their last able farmers, sent inferior men to the army. A report of 1848 showed that during recent levies, one-third of the conscripts had been rejected because they had failed to meet the necessary height requirement, a mere 160 centimeters, and another half had been rejected because of chronic illness or other physical deficiencies. The only way to solve the army's shortages of manpower would have been to widen its social base of conscription and move towards a European system of universal military service, but this would have spelled the end of serfdom, the foundation of the social system to which the aristocracy was firmly committed. Despite two decades of reform, the Russian military remained far behind the armies of the other European states. The officer corps was poorly educated and almost all the troops illiterate. Official figures of the 1850s showed that in a group of six divisions, numbering approximately 120,000 men, only 264, 0.2%, were able to read or write. The ethos of the army was dominated by the 18th-century parade ground culture of the Tsarist court, in which promotion, to quote Karl Marx, was limited to martinets, whose principal merit consists of stolid obedience and ready servility, added to accuracy of eyesight in detecting a fault in the buttons and buttonholes on the uniform. There was more emphasis on the drilling and appearance of the troops than on their battle-worthiness. Even during fighting, there were elaborate rules for the posture, length of stride, line and movement of the troops, all set out in army manuals, which were quite irrelevant to the actual conditions of the battlefield. When a battle formation is advancing or retiring, it is necessary to observe a general alignment of the battalions in each line and to maintain correctly the intervals between battalions. In this case, it is not enough for each battalion separately to keep alignment, it is necessary that the pace be alike in all battalions, so that the guidon sergeant marching before the battalions shall keep alignment among themselves and march parallel to one another along lines perpendicular to the common formation. The domination of this parade culture was connected to the backwardness of the army's weaponry. The importance attached to keeping troops in tight columns was partly to maintain their discipline and prevent chaos when there were large formations on the move, as in other armies of the time. But it was also necessitated by the inefficiency of the Russian musket and the consequent reliance on the bayonet, justified by patriotic myths about the bravery of the Russian soldier who was at his best with the bayonet. Such was the neglect of small arms fire in the infantry that very few men even knew how to use their muskets, according to one officer. "With us, success in battle was entirely staked on the art of marching and the correct stretching of the toe." These outdated means of fighting had brought Russia victory in all the major wars of the early 19th century, against the Persians and the Turks, and, of course, in Russia's most important war, against Napoleon, a triumph that convinced the Russians that their army was invincible. So there had been little pressure to update them for the needs of warfare in the new age of steam and the telegraph. Russia's economic backwardness and financial weakness compared to the new industrial powers of the West also placed a severe brake on the modernization of its vast and expensive peacetime army. It was only during the Crimean War, when the musket was shown to be useless against the Minié rifle of the British and the French, that the Russians ordered rifles for their own army. Of the 80,000 Russian troops who crossed the River Pruth, the border between Russia and Moldavia, less than half would survive for a year. The Tsarist army lost men at a far higher rate than any of the other European armies. Soldiers were sacrificed in huge numbers for relatively minor gains by aristocratic senior officers who cared little for the welfare of their peasant conscripts, but a great deal for their own promotion if they could report a victory to their superiors. the vast majority of Russian soldiers were not killed in battle, but died from wounds and diseases that might not have been fatal had there been a proper medical service. Every Russian offensive told the same sad tale. In 1828-9, half the army died from cholera and illnesses in the Danubian principalities. During the Polish campaign of 1830-31, 7,000 Russian soldiers were killed in combat, but 85,000 were carried off by wounds and sickness. During the Hungarian campaign of 1849, only 708 men died in the fighting, but 57,000 Russian soldiers were admitted to Austrian hospitals. Even in peacetime, the average rate of sickness in the Russian army was 65%. The appalling treatment of the serf soldier lay behind this high rate of illness. Floggings were a daily aspect of the disciplinary system, beatings so common that entire regiments could be made up of men who carried wounds inflicted by their own officers. The supply system was riddled with corruption because officers were very badly paid. The whole army was chronically underfunded by the cash-strapped Tsarist government, and by the time they had taken their profit from the sums they were allowed to buy provisions with, there was little money left for the rations of the troops. Without an effective system of supply, soldiers were expected to fend largely for themselves. Each regiment was responsible for the manufacturing of its uniforms and boots with materials provided by the state. Regiments not only had their own tailors and cobblers, but their own barbers, bakers, blacksmiths, carpenters and metal workers, joiners, painters, singers and bandsmen, all of them bringing their own village trades into the army. Without these peasant skills, a Russian army, let alone an army on the offensive, would not have been feasible. The Russian soldier on the march drew on all his peasant know-how and resourcefulness. He carried bandages in his knapsack so that he could treat himself for wounds. He was very good at improvising ways to sleep in the open, using leaves and branches, haystacks, crops, and even digging himself into a hole in the ground, a crucial skill that helped the army to go on long marches without the need to carry tents. As the Russians crossed the Pruth, the Turkish government ordered Omar Pasha, the commander of the Rumelian army, to strengthen the Turkish forts along the Danube and prepare for their defence. The port also called for reinforcements from the Ottoman dominions of Egypt and Tunis. By mid-August, there were 20,000 Egyptian troops and 8,000 Tunisians encamped around Constantinople and ready to depart for the Danubian forts. A British embassy official described them in a letter to Lady Stratford de Redcliffe. "'Tis a pity you can't see the Bosphorus about Therapia, swarming with ships of war, and the opposite heights crowned with the green tents of the Egyptian camp. Constantinople has itself gone back 50 years, and the strangest figures swarm in from the distant provinces to have a cut at the Muscovite. Turbans, lances, maces, and battle-axes jostle each other in the narrow streets and are bundled off immediately to the camp at Shumla for the sake of a quiet life." The Turkish army was made up of many nationalities. It included Arabs, Kurds, Tatars, Egyptians, Tunisians, Albanians, Greeks, Armenians, and other peoples, many of them hostile to the Turkish government or unable to understand the commands of their Turkish or European officers. Omar Pasha's staff contained many Poles and Italians. The most colourful of the Turkish forces were the Bashi Bazouks, irregulars from North Africa, Central Asia and Anatolia, who left their tribes in bands of 20 or 30 at a time, a motley bunch of cavalrymen of all ages and appearances, and made their way to the Turkish capital to join the jihad against the Russian infidels. In his memoirs of the Crimean War, the British naval officer Adolphus Slade, who helped to train the Turkish navy, described a parade of the Bashi Bazouks in Constantinople before they were sent off to the Danubian front. They were mostly dressed in old tribal gear, sashed and turbaned and picturesquely armed with pistols, yatagan, Turkish sword, and sabre. Some carried pennoned lances. Each squadron had its colours and its kettle drums, of the fashion of those, if not the same, carried by their ancestors, who had marched to the siege of Vienna. They spoke so many different languages that even within small units, translators and criers had to be employed to shout out the orders of the officers. Language was not the only problem of command. Many Muslim soldiers were unwilling to obey Christian officers. Even Omar Pasha, a Croatian Serb and Orthodox by birth, his real name was Mihajlo Latas, who had been educated in an Austrian military school before fleeing from corruption charges to the Ottoman province of Bosnia and converting to Islam. Jocular and talkative, Omar Pasha enjoyed the luxurious lifestyle that his command of the Rumelian army had afforded him. He dressed in a uniform decorated with gold braid and precious stones, kept a private harem, and employed an orchestra of Germans to accompany his troops. In the Crimea, he had them play A Che la Morte from Verdi's recent opera Il Trovatore. Omar Pasha was not an outstanding commander. It was said that he had been promoted on the basis of his beautiful handwriting. He had been the writing master of the young Abdulmejid and had been made a colonel when his pupil became sultan in 1839. In this sense, despite his Christian birth, Omar Pasha was typical of the Ottoman officer class, which still depended on personal patronage for promotion rather than on military expertise. The military reforms of Mahmud's reign and the Tanzimat had yet to create the foundations of a modern professional army, and the majority of Turkish officers were tactically weak on the battlefield. Many still adhered to the outmoded strategy of dispersing their troops to cover every bit of ground rather than deploying them in larger and more compact groups. The Ottoman army was good at small war, ambushes and skirmishing, and excellent at siege warfare, but it had long lacked the discipline and training to master close-order formations using smoothbore muskets, unlike the Russians. In terms of pay and conditions, there was a huge gulf between the officers and the soldiers, a divide even wider than in the Russian army, with many senior commanders living like pashas and their troops left unpaid for several months, sometimes even years, during a war. The Russian diplomat and geographer Pyotr Chikhachev reported on the problem when he worked at the Russian embassy in Constantinople in 1849. In his calculation, the annual cost of the Turkish infantry soldier, salary, rations and clothing, was 18 silver rubles. The equivalent costs for the Russian soldier were 32 rubles, for the Austrian 53 rubles, for the Prussian 60 rubles, for the French 85 rubles, and for the British foot soldier 134 rubles. European soldiers were shocked by the conditions of the Turkish troops on the Danubian front. Poorly fed and dressed in rags, they were the most wretched specimens of humanity, according to one British officer. The Egyptian reinforcements were described by a Russian officer as old men and country boys without any training for battle. The British were divided in their reaction to the Russian occupation of the principalities. The most pacific member of the cabinet was the Prime Minister, Lord Aberdeen. He refused to see the occupation as an act of war. He even thought it had been partly justified to press the Porte to recognise the Russians' legitimate demands in the Holy Lands and looked for diplomatic ways to help the Tsar retreat without losing face. He certainly was not inclined to encourage Turkish resistance. His greatest fear was being drawn into a war against Russia by the Turks, whom he generally mistrusted. In February, he had written to Lord Russell to warn against the sending of a British fleet to help the Turks. "These barbarians hate us all, and would be delighted to take their chance of some advantage by embroiling us with the other powers of Christendom. It may be necessary to give them our moral support and to endeavour to prolong their existence, but we ought to regard as the greatest misfortune any engagement which compelled us to take up arms for the Turks." At the more belligerent end of the cabinet, Palmerston thought the occupation was a hostile act that demanded immediate action by Britain for the protection of Turkey. He wanted British warships in the Bosporus to put pressure on the Russians to withdraw from the principalities. Palmerston was supported by the Russophobic British press and by anti-Russian diplomats such as Ponsonby and Stratford Canning, who saw the occupation of the principalities as an opportunity for Britain to make good on its failure to oppose the Russians on the Danube in 1848-9. London had a large community of Romanian exiles from the previous Russian occupation of the principalities who formed an influential pressure group for British intervention that enjoyed the support of several members of the cabinet, including Palmerston and Gladstone, and many more MPs who lobbied Parliament with questions about the Danube. The Romanian leaders had close connections to the Italian exiles in London and were part of the Democratic Committee established by Mazzini, which by this time had also been joined by Greek and Polish exiles in the British capital. The Romanians were careful to distance themselves from the revolutionary politics of these nationalists and were well aware of the need to tailor their arguments to the liberal interests of the British middle classes. With the support of several national newspapers and periodicals, they succeeded in getting across to the British public the idea that the defence of the principalities against Russian aggression was vitally important for the broader interests of liberty and free trade on the continent. In a series of almost daily articles in the Morning Advertiser, Urquhart joined their calls for intervention in the principalities, although he was more concerned about the defence of Turkish sovereignty and Britain's free trade interests than about the Romanian national cause. As the Russian invasion of the principalities progressed, Romanian propagandists grew bolder and made direct appeals to the public on speaking tours. In all their speeches, the main theme was the European crusade for freedom against Russian tyranny. A rallying cry that was at times extremely fanciful in its vision of a Christian uprising for liberty in the Ottoman Empire. Constantine Rossetti, for example, told a crowd in Plymouth that an army of 100,000 Romanians stood ready on the Danube to join the soldiers of democracy. While the nature of the Russian occupation of the principalities remained unclear, the British government hesitated over where to send the Royal Navy. Palmerston and Russell wanted British warships in the Bosporus to prevent the Russian fleet attacking Constantinople, but Aberdeen preferred to hold the navy back in order not to threaten a negotiated peace. In the end, a compromise was reached, and the fleet was kept on a war footing at Besheka Bay, just outside the Dardanelles, close enough, so the thinking went, to deter a Russian attack on the Turkish capital, but not close enough to provoke a conflict between Britain and Russia. Then, in July, the Russian occupation of the principalities began to assume a more serious character. Reports reached the European capitals that the hospodars of Moldavia and Wallachia had been ordered by the Russians to break off relations with the port and to pay tribute to the Tsar instead. The news caused alarm because it suggested that Russia's real intention was to take possession of the principalities on a permanent basis, despite the assurances of the Tsar's manifesto to the contrary. The reaction of the European powers was immediate. The Austrians mobilized 25,000 troops on their southern frontiers, mainly as a warning to the Serbs and other Habsburg Slavs not to rise up in support of the Russian invasion. The French put their fleet on a war footing, and the British followed them. Stratford Canning, who had first heard the news of the order to the hospodars, and who was eager to make amends for the failure of the British to make a stand against the last Russian invasion in 1848-9, called for decisive military action to defend the principalities. He warned the Foreign Office that the whole of European Turkey, from the frontier of Austria to that of Greece, was about to fall to the Russians, that if they crossed the Danube, there would be uprisings by Christians everywhere in the Balkans, that the Sultan and his Muslim subjects were prepared for war against Russia, provided they could rely on the support of Britain and France, and that while it would be a misfortune for Britain to be dragged into a war whose consequences were so unpredictable, it would be better to deal with the danger of Russia now than later on, when it would be too late. The threatening nature of the Russian occupation raised a bundle of security concerns for the European powers, none of which could afford to stand by while Russia dismantled the Ottoman Empire. Britain, France, Austria, and Prussia, which basically followed Austria's lead, now agreed to act together in a peace initiative. The diplomatic lead was taken by Austria, the key guarantor of the Vienna settlement, of which it was the major beneficiary. The Austrians were heavily dependent on the Danube for their foreign trade and could not tolerate the Russian annexation of the principalities, yet could least afford a European war against Russia in which they were likely to bear the heaviest burden. What the Austrians proposed was probably impossible, a diplomatic solution that would allow the Tsar to drop his demands and withdraw from the principalities without losing face. The peace process involved an elaborate exchange of diplomatic notes between the European capitals, with endless variations on the precise wording of a formula to satisfy the interests of Russia and underline the independence of Turkey. The culmination of this activity was the Vienna Note, drafted by the foreign ministers of the four powers at a conference in Vienna on behalf of the Turkish government on the 28th of July. Like all diplomatic documents designed to end hostilities, the wording of the note was deliberately vague. The Porte agreed to uphold the treaty rights of Russia to protect the Orthodox subjects of the Sultan. The Tsar saw the note as a diplomatic victory and agreed to sign it at once, without modifications, on the 5th of August. The trouble started when the Turks, who had not even been consulted on the drafting of the note, asked for details to be clarified. They were concerned that the note had not set proper limits on the Russian right to intervene in Ottoman affairs, a concern that was soon proved to be justified when a private diplomatic document was leaked to a Berlin newspaper showing that the Russians had interpreted the note to mean that they could intervene to protect the Orthodox anywhere throughout the Ottoman Empire and not just in areas where a specific conflict had occurred, as in the Holy Lands. The Sultan suggested a couple of minor verbal alterations to the note, forms of words, but important to a government that was being asked to sign the note as a concession to Russia or face the loss of two of its richest provinces. He also wanted the Russians to evacuate the principalities before the re-establishment of diplomatic relations, and a guarantee from the four powers that Russia would not invade them again. These were reasonable demands for a sovereign power to insist upon, but the Tsar refused to accept the Turkish modifications on the ground that he had agreed to sign the note unchanged, although his suspicion that Stratford Canning had encouraged the Turks to dig in their heels was also not irrelevant. In early September, the Vienna Note was reluctantly abandoned by the four powers, and, with Turkey on the brink of declaring war on Russia, negotiations had to start again. In fact, contrary to the Tsar's suspicions, Stratford Canning had played a minor role in the Turkish decision to reject the note. The British ambassador was well known for his fierce defence of Turkish sovereignty and his hatred of Russia, so it was not surprising that he was held responsible for the unexpected refusal of the Turks to go along with the diplomatic solution imposed on them by the Western powers to appease the Tsar. The idea that Stratford had pushed the Turks towards a war against Russia was later taken up by the Foreign Office, which took the view that the ambassador might have persuaded the Turks to accept the note if he had gone about it in the right manner, but that he had chosen not to because he is himself no better than a Turk, and has lived there so long and is animated with such personal hatred of the Russian Emperor that he is full of the Turkish spirit, and this and his temper together have made him take a part directly contrary to the wishes and instructions of his government. Looking back on the failure of peace on the 1st of October, Foreign Secretary Lord George Clarendon concluded that it would have been better to have had a more moderate man than Stratford as ambassador in the Turkish capital. The game of deceit the Russians played called forth all his Russian antipathies and made him from the first look to war as the best thing for Turkey. In fact, no settlement would have been satisfactory to him that did not humiliate Russia. But this was unfair to Stratford, who took the blame for the failure of the government. The truth is that Stratford did his best to get the port to accept the note, but his influence on the Turks was steadily declining in the summer months as Constantinople was swept by demonstrations calling for a holy war against Russia. The invasion of the principalities stirred a powerful combination of Muslim feeling and Turkish nationalism in the Ottoman capital. The port had roused the Muslim population against the invasion and now could not contain the ensuing religious emotions. The language of the metropolitan ulema was increasingly belligerent, raising fears among the devout that the invaders would destroy their mosques and build churches in their place. Meanwhile, the port kept the public ignorant about the Vienna Initiative, claiming that any peace would come solely from the Tsar's awe of the Sultan, an idea that encouraged nationalist feelings of Muslim superiority. Rumours circulated that the Sultan was paying the British and French navies to fight for Turkey, that Europe had been chosen by Allah to defend the Muslims, that the Tsar had sent his wife to Constantinople to beg for peace and had offered to repay Turkey for the invasion of the principalities by giving up the Crimea. Many of these rumours were engineered or promoted by the recently dismissed Grand Vizier Mehmet Ali to undermine Rashid. By the end of August, Mehmet Ali had emerged as the head of a war party which had gained the ascendancy within the Grand Council. Backed by Muslim leaders, he enjoyed the support of a large group of younger Turkish officials who were nationalist and religious and opposed to Western intervention in Ottoman affairs, but calculated nonetheless that if they could involve the British and the French on their side in a war against Russia, this would be hugely to their advantage and might even reverse 100 years of military defeats by the Russians. To secure the support of the Western fleets, they were prepared to promise sound administration to interfering Europeans like Stratford, but they rejected the Tanzimat reforms because they saw the granting of more civil rights to Christians as a potential threat to Muslim rule. The war mood in the Turkish capital reached fever pitch during the second week of September, when there was a series of pro-war demonstrations and a mass petition with 60,000 signatures calling on the government to launch a holy war against Russia. The theological schools, medrese, and mosques were the organizing centers of the protests, and their influence was clearly marked in the religious language of the posters that appeared throughout the capital. O glorious Padishah! All your subjects are ready to sacrifice their lives, property, and children for the sake of your majesty. You too have now incurred the duty of unsheathing the sword of Muhammad that you girded in the mosque of Ayyubi Ansari like your grandfathers and predecessors. The hesitations of your ministers on this question stem from their addiction to the disease of vanity, and this situation has the possibility, God forbid, of leading us all into a great danger. Therefore, your victorious soldiers and your praying servants want war for the defence of their clear rights, O my Padishah. There were 45,000 religious students in the medrese of the Turkish capital. They were discontented as a group. The Tanzimat reforms had reduced their status and career prospects by promoting graduates of the new secular schools, and this social grievance gave a cutting edge to their protests. The Turkish government was terrified of the possibility of an Islamic revolution if it failed to declare war against Russia. On the 10th of September, 35 religious leaders submitted a petition to the Grand Council, which discussed it the next day. According to the London Times, the petition was principally composed of numerous quotations from the Quran enjoining war on the enemies of Islam and contained covert threats of disturbance were it not listened to and complied with. The tone of the petition is exceedingly bold and bordering on the insolent. Some of the principal ministers endeavoured to reason with those who presented it, but the answers they obtained were short and to the point. Here are the words of the Quran. If you are Muslims, you are bound to obey. You are now listening to foreign and infidel ambassadors who are the enemies of the faith. We are the children of the Prophet. We have an army, and that army cries out with us for war, to avenge the insults which the Zhaoers have heaped upon us. It is said that on each attempt to reason with these fanatics, the ministers were met by the answer, "These are the words of the Quran." The present ministers are undoubtedly in a state of alarm, since they look upon the present circumstance, a very unusual event in Turkey, as but the commencement of a revolution, and fear to be forced at the present inopportune juncture into a war. On the 12th of September, the religious leaders gained an audience with the Sultan. They gave him an ultimatum: either declare war or abdicate. Abdul-Majid turned for help to Stratford and the French ambassador, Edmond de la Cour, who both agreed to bring up their fleets if they were needed to put down a revolution in the Turkish capital. That evening, the Sultan called a meeting of his ministers. They agreed to declare war against Russia, although not until the Porte had time to firm up the support of the Western fleets and put down the religious protests in Constantinople. The policy was formally agreed at an enlarged session of the Grand Council on the 26th to 7th of September, attended by the Sultan's ministers, leading Muslim clerics and the military establishment. It was the religious leaders who insisted on the need to fight, despite the hesitations of the military commanders who had their doubts about the capacity of the Turkish forces to win a war against Russia. Omar Pasha thought that 40,000 more troops would be needed on the Danube, where it would require several months to prepare the forts and bridges for a war against Russia. Mehmet Ali, who had recently been appointed commander-in-chief of the army, would not say whether it was possible to win against Russia, despite his association with the war party. Nor would Mahmud Pasha, the Grand Admiral of the Navy, who said the Turks could match the Russian fleet, but would not take responsibility for these words if later called to account for a defeat. In the end, it was Rashid who came round to the viewpoint of the Muslim leaders, perhaps sensing that to oppose war at this late stage would spark a religious revolution and destroy the Tanzimat reforms, upon which the support of the Western powers in any war with Russia would depend. "Better to die fighting than not to fight at all," declared Rashid. "God willing, we will be victorious."